pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
And Scott, thank you very much for that introduction. Welcome listeners to episode 4 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. You know who we are, and Scott's with me. And Scott, how are you this fine evening?
Never better, Trevor. It's been a little bit of a slow week as far as the news goes, but it may be this time it's more about quality rather than quantity, because the articles the items that we have looked at, they seem rather meaty. So it's a small smorgasbord this week.
I think you're right. I think it's not like there's dozens of them, but the ones that are there have got plenty on them. So I think...
Agreed.
First of all, we've got Bill Shorten and the Royal Commission into Unions. So,
yeah, you know, regardless of how the opposition leader tries to spin it, he didn't come out smelling of roses.
He didn't, no.
No. And, I was listening to a conservative caller on one of the ABC shows, and he made the point that it would be a real pity if more moderate unions were actually kicked in the face like this, and the CFMEU and the BLF and the MUA and all the rest of it managed to get the oxygen.
Yes.
Because his argument was actually quite a good one. He made the point that longer term, workers were probably better off with more moderate unions because it meant that they had longevity in their employment, as opposed to the more militant unions that, you know, in his words, would put their foot on the throat of the employer and keep going until they stop breathing. So I thought that was a reasonable argument.
Yeah, I guess there's an argument that a union advocate could be so successful that get such a great wage deal a company could go broke. But just to give some people background who haven't been reading and
Absolutely.
Haven't been keeping up with it, so essentially Bill Shorten's been hauled before a royal commission. And, well, let's start with, should there be a royal commission in the first place? Because Julia Gillard had to appear before a royal commission in relation to her affairs at one stage. And this is another royal commission initiated by Tony Abbott and the Conservative government. And, you know, part of me says, if they've committed an offence of some sort in terms of taking bribes or doing something illegal, then don't we have a director of prosecutions and a police force who can charge people and bring them before the courts?
To be honest, that's my opinion. I think that, the accusation's been made this is a political witch hunt. It's starting to look and smell like one. I would have thought that if there are accusations made, then the proper place to put those accusations is initially to the police. The police then take a brief to the DPP, and the DPP decides whether or not there's a case to answer and charges if they do believe there's a case to answer.
Yeah.
So I would have thought that we already had a reasonably functioning justice system anyway. If they need to have an inquiry, surely a Senate committee would be enough.
Yeah, I think it's a particularly ugly and nasty way of going after your political opponents and hauling them
it's
before.
An expensive way of doing it too.
Yeah,
you know, what's the bill so far? They reckon it's going to end at $80 million, whereas I think the meat is now at $61 million.
Yeah, I'd hate to think how much all the QCs are costing, but I just think at the end of the day, you know, if there's smoke and there's an issue and somebody's potentially done something wrong, then that's what we have a police and a justice system for.
Well, I tend to agree. I'm not convinced that it was the right thing to spend up to $80 million on.
Mm.
But the thing that did worry me was there was a comment by Senator Carr from the ALP. He was the industry minister in the last government. You know, the bigger bloke with the beard.
Mm-hmm.
Now he had. He made the point in a doorstop interview. He says, well, maybe when we get back into office, we should have a royal commission into the funding of the Liberal Party.
No doubt.
And I thought to myself, and you know what? I think he's, in a way, he's right. The government has set a very dangerous precedent that you're just going to have these bloody royal commissions into each other.
Yep.
And, you know, it's, I fear it's a further evidence of the decline of our political system, because we're no longer in a combat, in a place where there's a competition of ideas. It's now who can sling the most mud and who can make it stick.
Yep. So it's a sort of a grubby way to go about things. But okay.
So we've
We've got a royal commission and bills hauled in front of it. And allegations are made that certain employer groups paid certain money at the same time that Bill Shorten and or the AWU were involved in negotiating agreements, or would be at some stage in the future. And so we had a labour hire company, Unibuilt, which paid some money. The money was used for funding Bill Shorten's campaign director. And only recently, in the last couple of months or month, did Bill Shorten actually declare that. When he's gone through his records and realised what's coming up, he's made a declaration. And another company, Clean Event, which paid some money as well. Bill Shorten argued that it wasn't relevant to the time that he was there. So all a bit hazy as to when, how the money actually was funneled through and what it was used for and who was in charge and who was in charge of the agreements at the time. But the essential sort of notion is employer companies paying money to a union in a situation where either then or at some stage in the future, the union would be likely to be acting for the employees against those companies. So you've got a situation where workers are selling something, i.e. their labour, and you've got a company that's buying it, i.e. by paying wages, and the problem is this perceived conflict of interest. So, you know, on the one hand, you're arguing against a company and trying to get workers a better deal, yet on the other hand, you're accepting benefits from a company. And one of the responses of people on behalf of Bill Shorten, or I think he even said it himself, was, well, you know, we got X percent sort of wage increase for the employees. Nobody could say it wasn't a good deal. But the problem is that conflicts of interest are all about perception. Like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how good a deal you get. You just shouldn't have conflicts of interest.
Yeah.
So,
and you've hit the nail right on the head. You know, and in the court of public opinion, you don't need beyond reasonable doubt. You don't even need the lesser burden of proof, you know, the, what is it, beyond, well, not beyond reasonable doubt, the other one in civil matters, that lesser
balance of probabilities.
Proof. Balance of probabilities. You don't even need that. All you need is perception.
Yep. But, you know, in ordinary commercial affairs, where people are acting as agents or assistants or advisors for one group, you just have to keep the other group completely at arm's distance and have nothing to do with them. So, you know, in my previous life when I was a lawyer, the most simple of transactions where you've got a buyer and a seller, you couldn't contemplate for an instant acting for both the buyer and the seller at the same time. You just knew you were in a total negligence territory if you were to do that.
Well, my understanding is you're prohibited from acting for both parties, aren't you?
Well, you are by the laws that if one of them wants to turn around and sue you, you've got nothing to stand on. So there was no defence of, oh, well, you know, everybody was happy with the deal. It's the fact that you just can't act for opposing parties at the same time. And just another little anecdote on this sort of thing that I can remember, because I did my articles with a law firm that was very big on family law. And one of the other big family law firms in Brisbane, one of the partners was going through a separation divorce. And what he did was he went round to all the other really good family law firms and got some preliminary advice from them all as to his rights and in his situation. And the reason why he went to all of them was that it then meant that they could not act for his wife when she came knocking on the door.
Oh, God.
And there's an example of conflict of interest. So these other champions...
Or abusive process.
Well, but he was using the conflict of interest provisions. So having given advice to him, he then walked away and either did it himself or used one of the six law firms that he consulted. But the other five were then prohibited from acting for the wife because they had acted for him at one stage and given advice. So that's how, in the world of advice, that's how conflict of interest just puts a full stop to certain things. So,
yeah, precisely.
So when it comes to Bill Shorten, doesn't look good.
No, I mean, it doesn't look good, but, and they haven't really... I personally think it should open up a wider conversation about how you fund the political process.
Mm. But before we get onto that, I know...
No, I'm not, yeah.
We're going to head to that.
We are going to head to that, yep. That's fine then.
So I just want to say...
Hold fire
on that thought. But I just want to say, do we have a commission? Probably we shouldn't do it through the normal channels. Bills look bad. I think Tony Abbott looks really bad for bringing it on. It's just a nasty thing to do.
He looks churlish.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
And one of the things that came from it was that after he appeared at the Royal Commission and answered some questions, Bill Shorten fronted the media. And the level of oratory in Australian politics is just terrible. I mean, the other day we had, I'm the first person who, I don't like Amazing Grace, but when you saw the President of the United States giving that eulogy and singing Amazing Grace, it was a magnificent piece of showmanship and communication which our leaders could only dream of. And Bill Shorten, fighting for his political life, walks out of the Royal Commission, and I'll give you one guess: is his advisors would have said to him, or he's worked it out himself, that he's got to just get one word across to the public about his feelings about this whole thing. And I'm going to play you a little segment here of what he had to say. And Scott, I want you to guess what that word was. Okay?
Politics of smear. Tony Abbott Royal Commission to smear their opponents. Politics of smear. Politics of smear, then engaging in political smear campaigns. Just to smear your political rivals. Not a political smear campaign. It certainly has been a smear campaign by the Liberals to just investigate and smear their rivals. You can see a smear campaign funded by the taxpayer, not this politics of smear. Tens of millions of dollars of taxpayer money on a political smear campaign.
Scott, what word do you reckon that was?
I wouldn't want to smear the leader of the opposition, but do you think perhaps his advisor had told him, Bill, whatever else you do, make sure you get across the point that this was a smear against you? Do you think, am I on the right track, Trevor?
I think you are, Scott. I think you are. But there's one other thing from this, and that's actually a video that I recorded. And as I was recording it, I was looking at the video. Now, I've got a policy here, Scott, and I haven't run this past you before, but I'm keen to see what you think. This is a policy that I reckon will win an election for any party who wants to take it on, and it doesn't matter. A local, state, federal, this policy, Scott, is the killer policy. Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
And I'm gonna say it's a secular party policy right now, so people can feel free to vote for us. But the policy is that we at the secular party, I guarantee the Australian public that when interviewed, we will not have a bunch of people or even a single person standing behind us, nodding their head sagely in agreement with what we say. And giving all of the sort of Marcel Marceau miming techniques that you see all the time. What do you reckon, Scott? Is that a winner?
Well, I think that's a great winner, because so many times you just sit there and you think to yourself, goodness me, it's naughty in big ears, you know? It's just used so much now, they look stupid doing it.
And it's
true. So I think you're on a real winner there.
There we go. Yeah,
and I will be more than happy to second that when it goes through policy committee, for sure.
I'm going to talk to our website guru and Secular Party and, you know, forget about education and tax reform. Right at the very top, I think we're going to put
ban the nod.
No, yeah. Nodding heads in interviews.
Say no to the nod.
Yes. So, and one more thing. Just before we leave the commission and go on to political donations in general, and I've said that Bill looked bad and Tony looked bad, and I found a really interesting thing from a website, blog sort of site by a guy called John Menadou, and he came up with something.
So that's a name I'm not familiar with.
Yeah.
I must have a look. Yeah.
He came up with something really interesting, because the Royal Commissioner that we've got at the moment was a bit, wasn't really impressed by Bill Shorten, sort of suggested he was a bit wordy in some of his answers, and was sort of saying to him...
I think I did recall the word evasive being used. Mm. That was from the commissioner, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know about evasive. It might have been. It was a strange sort of comment. He was kind of saying to him, look, just thinking of your self-interest here, you're sort of being a bit wordy, you might want to be a bit direct, you head off into tangents, not sure if this is looking good for you. You're sort of using phrases like that, which is interesting. But he made a very interesting comment in respect of Julia Gillard. So when he was the Royal Commissioner, same guy, he said...
The former High Court judge, isn't he?
Indeed, yeah. Dyson Heydon. He said, in relation to Julia Gillard, I'll quote it here, her intense degree of preparation, her familiarity with the materials, her acuteness and her powerful instinct for self-preservation made it difficult to judge her credibility. Now, I reckon that's a really harsh comment to make. Like, criticising Julia Gillard for her intense degree of preparation, her familiarity with the materials, and saying that with her instinct for self-preservation made it difficult to judge her credibility? I don't know.
What was would he have preferred if she'd turned up completely unprepared?
Yeah. Like, I'm sort of thinking, well, if Dyson Heydon talks about a witness and questions what they're saying in terms of their credibility, I'm just going to add a little grain of salt into that. I just, that previous comment was a strange thing to say in relation to Julia Gillard.
It's fairly brutal.
Mm. So anyway, that was interesting from John Menadou's blog. But now, Scott, having said all that, conflicts of interest and political donations in general, what would you like to say?
Well, look, you know, and goes back to that perception, the point about perception that you made. It may well be true that absolutely nothing untoward goes on when an organisation or an individual makes a large political donation to a party and then ends up the beneficiary of legislation.
Mm.
But the perception's still there, and one of the, you know, if... Well, let's look up in our own home state here. Clive Palmer bankrolled the LNP to the tune of more than $1 million, is my understanding at the time.
Mm.
And then when he had his public falling out with the LNP state government, there was accusations and rumours that he had arrived in George Street and basically said, okay, boys, here's the legislation I want you to pass.
Yes.
Now, that was the accusation.
Mm.
Now, even if that accusation had never come out publicly and had the spat not actually happened, but the Galilee Basin had been developed exactly the way Clive wanted it to, the perception would have been, well, he bought his Galilee Basin for $1 million or $2 million it was. He bankrolled the LNP.
That's the problem when you allow political donations.
Well,
of that sum, of that size.
Of that magnitude, I think, is the problem.
Hmm.
I would be more inclined to support a And this was a line Malcolm Turnbull ran once. It's not Liberal Party policy, but he actually said it on Q&A, I think, when he was in the wilderness. I don't even think he was on the front bench. So he was able to say whatever the hell he wanted. And one of the things he made the point on was he felt that it was time to restrict political donations to natural human beings. So a company, a trade union, a lobby group, a church, anything like that would be unable to make a contribution to the political parties.
Yeah.
You'd have to be a member of the human race to do so. And then you'd obviously, on top of all that, you'd have to then restrict the amount per person and so on and so forth.
Yep.
It's probably going to then require one or two things, either a far more modest political campaign so that the parties are no longer heavily reliant on radio and television, and maybe even go back to, gee, the real old days when they used to stand up in the back of the ute with a loudhailer and talk to people, which I don't think would be a bad thing anyway. But even if they, you know, the whole thing has to be looked at. For example, we do fund political parties in Australia. It's $1 and something or other for each primary vote they get, assuming they get, sorry, up to a maximum of $1 and something per primary vote, assuming they get more than 5% of the primary vote in the first place. Mm-hmm. What that does, though, is that it entrenches those who are already at the table. Because
which doesn't include the secular parties. That's where we're heading.
No, we're not there yet. So we're more than happy right now to agitate for change. I do think that with the way the system is currently set up, those people who are already there, who have already got their snouts very comfortably in the trough, such as the Greens, the ALP and the Liberal Party, they're always going to get a very large chunk of that public money, irrespective of what they may or may not have actually had to do to get that, you know, whereas new fledgling parties like the Secular Party of Australia, mm-hmm. who are, you know, just trying to get their foot in the door, unless they get 5% of the primary vote, get absolutely nothing, irrespective of how many members, for example, they have gone out and found in the last 12 months. So the whole system, in my view, has to be changed somehow to look at different KPIs other than just success at the election, because success at the election is going to naturally be easier for those who are already at the table to achieve.
Yeah. John Hewson said a similar thing. He said that it needed to be overhauled, and the only way to guarantee transparency was to ban all corporate or union donations and to limit individual donations to $1,000. So,
and, you know, that would not be unreasonable.
Yeah.
I really don't think it would be unreasonable. Yeah. To my way of thinking, you know, my smaller government bias, for example, would be it would force, and, you know, survival of the fittest attitude, it's been described before too, would be it would force the political parties to go out and find members and then actually not only recruit the members, but then get the members to fund, get the members to put their hand in their pocket for something they're supposed to believe in.
Yeah.
And that is the thing that I do think that when you have too much, when you have too much reliance on either corporate or union donations, you've not only got that perception that the coalition is in, well, we'll name in Rupert Murdoch's back pocket, mm-hmm. and that the ALP is in the back pocket of the ACTU. Whereas if you've got tens of thousands of members contributing $100 or $1,000, it's a lot harder to say that one particular person has bought influence. And these dinners where they pay $20,000 to have the treasurer at their table, I think that's rotten.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
You know, those sorts of stunts, they lead to the accusation and the perception that the treasurer could be bought. And of course, I didn't actually say that he was for sale, because I've got shallower pockets than what the Fairfax Media Group does, and I can't come up with $200,000.
Yes. So,
but I think it's an area that's ripe for reform. It really does need to be fixed.
I think so, and I think I reckon, and a lot of politicians would go for it as well, because, you know, in so many things we follow the American sort of model over time, and certainly in America, the politicians there have to basically spend an enormous amount of their time begging for money. Like,
I don't know if you've ever seen it before, but there was a sitcom called Alpha House that was based, the premise of that show was that there are four Republican senators that live together in a house.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's a share accommodation thing, but with a political slant to it. And one of the guys, the big fat bloke that was Roseanne's husband, John, whatever his surname is, he was one of the Republican senators. He said, you know, we spend most of our time whoring for money so that we can then sell our souls.
Yeah.
And then come back to have a chance to go back whoring for money again.
Yeah.
I thought he's really hit the nail on the head.
I can remember listening to a podcast, I think it was This American Life or something like that. And
yeah, that's a good podcast, isn't it?
Even the candidates who, for whatever reason, had good access to lots of money because of the state they were in or other circumstances, they had to beg just as hard because they were expected to. Like, their budget was higher than the budget of a congressman or senator in a poorer district. So they were all under the gun of having to ring and ask for donations all the time. And so I reckon if you introduced a law to ban it, the actual participants would go, well, thank goodness for that. I don't have to keep making those terrible phone calls all the time. The only ones who get an easy run are perhaps is the Labor getting the money from the unions. I mean, that's probably a less uncomfortable sort of process for them, maybe.
Well, it's probably less uncomfortable because, let's face it, you know, if the statistics are still accurate, the majority of Labor members have actually got there through the well-worn path of becoming a trade union official and then a secretary of a branch and then a state secretary of the union and so on and so forth, and then going on to pre-selection. So they're probably still in contact with all their mates from those days. So it's probably less uncomfortable. You're right. I think it's probably less uncomfortable for them.
Mm.
But I also think that the most important part of it is just to remove the perception that they are in someone's hip pocket. And it will then actually enable them to be a little more honest with the electorate, in that they'll be able to say what they mean and do what they actually say, as opposed to going out having a thought bubble, which might actually one day be received popularly by the public, and then have the donors get on the phone saying, "There's no way you're doing that.
Mm.
Back off," you know. And I do think that it would lead to greater, you know, it will probably return us to the idea of politics being a battle, a contest of ideas.
Yeah.
You know, rather than who's got the deepest pockets and can buy the most airtime.
And I mean, it has been done. For example, in New South Wales, they have banned political donations from developers because
they could go the next level.
Yes. So So, you know, it was clearly a problem there and something could be done. So I reckon that's one that could go on the table.
I mean, having said that, I don't want our listeners to think that I've always got the cricket bat out for the coalition, but it did somewhat stink when the developers in New South Wales weren't allowed to contribute to the state party. So what they did was they had a fundraising organisation that contributed to the federal party, and the federal party then turned around and gave the money back to the state party.
Right.
So,
you obviously need some controls to stop that,
you'd need to make sure that if you're going to do this, that it was nationwide, that there wasn't one holdout state that said, no, you know, we'll let corporations act like people.
Mm.
And, you know, so that there can't be any then filtering of the money back through in back channels.
Mm.
But,
I think
it would lead to a better system over time. Initially they'll bleat about it because, you know, you won't be able to have all the advertising, but it would probably do two things. It would force the candidates to become more involved with the actual people that they intend to represent. And frankly, it'll also force the electorate to become more involved and find out just who it is they're planning on voting for.
Yeah.
And our elections might become less presidential and go back to the way the system was supposed to be, where you're actually electing a representative, not voting for a prime minister.
Well, I reckon we're on to two winners there. Get rid of the nodding heads in the background and get rid of excessive political advertising at election time. I mean, who wouldn't vote for that?
Well, I think a lot of people really, they would. When it came down to it, they'd be really impressed with an idea like that, because it's just, you know, watching TV during an election campaign, it's dangerous to your health.
Mm. Now, before we move on to the next serious topic, a quick one. Wimbledon, as you know,
yes.
I like my tennis, and I did threaten to expose anyone who I saw
praying.
Yes, at the conclusion of the match. And in the lead up to the final, they were doing a little bit of a run through of Djokovic's matches and Federer's matches, and typically showing the winning point in each one, or the last point in each match. And I regret to say that Djokovic, our current champion, he does the whole sign of the cross and the nod to God, and thanks for that one. So he's been struck off my favoured list and put on the other one. But yet another reason to be in love with Roger Federer is that, from my observation, nothing like that from his end. So there you go. That's the report on the praying athletes for this week.
Praying athletes from Wimbledon.
Yes. Oh,
thanks for that. Thanks to that for yeah. thanks for Trevor to coming to us courtside on that.
There we go. Now, we've mentioned last week Tony Abbott, the gift that keeps giving, or maybe it was Barnaby,
yes.
or maybe it was Barnaby Joyce, or both of them. But anyway, Tony's given us
both of them are gifts that do keep giving, though. Yes.
So what's Barnaby given us this week?
Well, unfortunately, it's one of those horrible times in life when you find yourself agreeing with someone. Now, those listeners out there who are my friends and family, you'll be well aware of my long-standing dispute with the Agriculture Minister. And unfortunately, I actually did agree with him this week. He's mm-hmm. He's found himself on the that natural battleground between miners and farmers. And given that he's from the National Party, and given that his family are farmers and that sort of stuff, not surprising that he's backed the farmers as opposed to the miners. Now, the decision that has come down was I hope I'm pronouncing this properly, the Shenhua Watermark Project, which is a gigantic coal mine in the Liverpool Plains.
Mm-hmm.
Liverpool Plains is probably Australia's premier farming region. It has exceptionally good soil and also very good water.
Mm.
Now, this dam is enormous. Mm. And
mine.
According to...
Mine or...
Oh, sorry, dam. It's a mine. Yes, it is a mine.
Yep.
It is an enormous mine. Mm. Now, I forget if it was in hectares or square kilometres, but it's 35 or 3,500 or something or other. It's massive.
Mm.
Now, you know, even though I dislike the Greens even more than I dislike Barnaby Joyce, they are right.
Yep.
You can't eat coal and you can't drink gas.
Yep.
So, for starters, the decision to actually dig up coal out of one of the best bits of farming area in the country, I think, is madness. The second thing on top of it all is that something that big, you're going to have to do a lot of work to convince me that it's not going to bugger up the water table.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said all that, Minister Hunt has given conditional approval, and he claims that there are 16... And, you know, I can't find the 16 points that they've got to comply with. Maybe I need to quit my day job, but to have more time to find these things. But Minister Hunt claims that this is the strictest restrictions ever that's been placed on a coal mine, and that he's got an on-off switch in his office that he can stop the thing straight away. But my understanding is, from what I've heard from people that have been interviewed on the issue, is that once you stuff the water table, you can't turn it off and you can't reverse it.
Yes.
So I do wonder if... And let's face it, climate change notwithstanding, at some point our species are going to have to stop digging up prehistoric forests from the paleo age and burning. We're going to have to stop doing that one of these days. So I just wonder if we mightn't be better off just stopping now.
It just, you know, it just can't be about money all the time. Like,
well, considering that the one of the phrases is that I've heard was that, well, we've had the mining boom, it's now time for the dining boom, and the suggestion is that Australia's next big thing is agricultural exports, why the hell are we risking our next big thing?
Yeah.
You know.
It does defy. I agree with you. Barnaby's right on this one. What do you think
he is. And
what do you
think? I mean, look, even a stop clock is right twice a day.
Yeah. What do you think of this sort of breach of cabinet solidarity type argument that's come out now?
I've always felt that everyone in Parliament, regardless of whether they're in the cabinet or not, should be allowed to speak as they see fit and, frankly, vote as they see fit.
Mm.
I think my personal opinion is that every vote should be a conscience vote. However, if the Liberal Party does not have as strict a rules as what the ALP does.
Mm.
You know, even the backbenchers in the ALP must vote the party line.
Mm.
I can only imagine, therefore, that the rules get even stricter as they make it to the cabinet. Now, the argument that's usually thrown around about that is usually by people like Corey Bernardi and Eric Abetz and that sort of stuff, saying that if you disagree with cabinet, you should leave the cabinet.
Mm.
Well, you know, I don't know about you, but I don't want a government that's full of yes men and women.
Mm.
I'd like to actually someone who's actually got a brain on their shoulders heavy enough to...
Look,
maybe disagree once in a while.
I reckon it's fair enough for a minister to say, well, in cabinet, I argued against it and I was outvoted, and so it is what it is. And I don't sort of have a problem with that. If they then continue to agitate and work towards something being overturned, or take it to another level, maybe then they should leave cabinet. But I don't really have a problem with somebody saying, well...
I think it's just we allegedly want our politicians to be honest.
Mm.
What can be more honest than them standing up in front of the cameras and saying, I disagreed with my cabinet colleagues, I think they've made a mistake, but I lost the vote.
Mm.
Why is that such a ridiculous thing?
Yep. I mean, you put, 20 people into a room, you're not going to get them to agree on everything, so...
Well, if you do, you've either got morons or completely weak-willed people.
Mm. Yep. So Barnaby's raised his objection to that, and there's all sorts of talk about that perhaps harming a future rise to leadership of his party. Do you think there's still a chance of being leader?
I mean, I think that's probably a little bit of wishful thinking on the part of the economic drivers in the Liberal Party than it is reality. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, who else have you got in the National Party once Warren Truss does go?
Mm.
It seems to me he's the most, he's certainly the most high-profile one. So I would have thought he still to this day remains the natural choice. And also, considering the problems the National Party's got from a Catter party or a, more moderate Hanson party, You would think that the National Party would be better off sticking with someone who's prepared to actually stand up and say, no, this is wrong because it's wrong for my constituents.
Yeah.
So I would have thought that he might be he should be their poster boy for their survival in the future. But we shall see. But I think that there's a piece from the Sydney Morning Herald, this is from the ABC, where they have an unnamed Liberal senator that said that the Chinese have raised concerns about Barnaby Joyce. I would be surprised if the Chinese know who Barnaby Joyce is.
Yep.
But anyway.
Yep.
Yeah. But I've just one final thing for our listeners. The politics of this is stupid because the independent who was from down that way is considering a return, Tony Windsor.
Yes.
Now, Barnaby Joyce won the seat that Windsor retired from, and apparently Windsor has now got a bigger spring into his step about having a political comeback on the basis of this mine approval.
Mm.
Now, considering the Liberal Party is supposed to hate Tony Windsor with an absolute passion,
mm.
Minister Hunt has just given a head start to Tony Windsor if he does decide to come back.
Yep, they've opened the door for him.
They have opened the door for him, absolutely.
Mm.
You know, and mining and farming are one of those things that they appear to be completely incompatible.
Mm.
And so to hand it over to basically hand it to Tony Windsor the way he has, they've they may well not have to worry about Barnaby being the leader of the National Party because he mightn't have a seat next time around.
Yep. Speaking of things that are incompatible.
Yes.
I think Tony Abbott and clean renewable energy are probably incompatible.
It's like a religious crusade, isn't it?
He just keeps astounding us, doesn't he? So for people who haven't kept up with it or heard a little bit about it and not sure what it is, basically we've got a fund which is called the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, which has got been given $10 billion. And their job is to help in the financing of clean energy projects in Australia, to try and work with other financiers and banks, providing money and helping things get off the ground and stay off the ground in the clean energy sector. And, well, number one, apparently it's been doing quite well in terms of commercial returns. Like, it's actually been making good money.
It's making good money, and it's something that it's, considering we're supposed to be in the depths of a budget emergency, considering the returns they're getting on it, it might be actually a good thing to invest in.
Yes. So
it's at that point that if they ever did cut it loose, it may well, it could stand on its own two feet.
Mm.
You'd probably have to get ideologically friendly investors to go into it, but considering the number of people that are prepared to invest in clean, green stocks, it could be something that could stand on its own two feet.
Yep. So anyway, they're set up to promote clean renewable energy, and they've been doing that in small-scale solar, and they've been doing it in large-scale wind farming. And Tony Abbott and his government have come out and given a directive to that corporation who's charged with financing clean renewable energy and told them, well, actually, there's a couple of areas we don't want you to be involved in anymore because we just don't like it. And that is, well, no, it wasn't because they just don't like it. They said that they want, or they said that the purpose of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation was to work with new and emerging technologies and not sort of old established ones. But that's completely wrong. Like, at no point in its charter is it limited in any way by that sort of restriction. And in fact, more or less at the same time that that body was set up, a separate body called ARENA, A-R-E-N-A, that was set up for the specific purpose of concentrating on new and emerging technologies. So
I was not aware of ARENA.
Yes.
Yeah, so I did not know that. Thank you.
So ARENA's mandate was to create and support renewable energy technology innovation, which is exactly what the Abbott government now says the CEFC was established to do. So it's, you know, so it's a nonsense for Abbott and his colleagues to say that's what it was there for. See, Abbott wanted to get rid of this corporation, and he can't.
Oh, yeah.
He doesn't have.
And the Senate blocked him.
So now he's trying to, you know, kill it by stealth in terms of limiting what it does. And, you know, wind technology, well, he doesn't like it, and Joe Hockey doesn't like it. But well, too bad. Just because you don't like it, it's a very viable source of renewable energy. And this,
well, I mean, Denmark this week has now generated more electricity than it can use from the wind.
Exactly. This week, they had a particularly windy week, but at one point they generated 140% of their electricity demand in Denmark from wind farms, and were able to export it to other countries, the excess power.
Yeah. But actually, you know, I've had a few trips to Britain where they've got a fair bit of wind farming too. I don't find them an offensive structure.
Mm.
You know, if anything, it's a symbol of human progress. Mm.
And this, you know, the sort of medical phenomena of people who live near solar, are these wind generating farms claiming the vibrations sort of make them ill?
Yeah, but my understanding is that we are the only nation on Earth that's reported it.
Correct.
Yeah, so either we are genetically unique species of human down here, or perhaps there's a little bit of hysteria that may or may not have been whipped up by Alan Jones.
Correct. We are the only country that has this medical phenomena. Doesn't exist anywhere else with wind farms.
And considering that wind farms are more advanced in places like Europe, there's a hell of a lot more of them, you would think that if they were causing health problems, they'd be reporting it in Wales and Scotland.
Yeah. I mean, it just goes to show what an embarrassment Tony Abbott and his colleagues are becoming on something as, you know, it's a feel-good story, the whole renewable energy thing, and he wants to stab it to death. It's like, he's like killing his, he wants to kill Bambi. That's what he's doing.
You forget, Fist, this is the man who said coal is good for humanity. You know, coal was good for humanity. It took us from horse-drawn carriages to steam engines and then eventually to electricity and so on and so forth. But it's had its day.
Yes.
It is. Well, it hasn't had its day, but it is now in its beginning its decline. And instead of trying to be at the forefront of finding the next set of technology, that are going to accelerate the decline of coal, our federal government appears to have taken the position, no, we're going to stand up for coal and try and, you know, I mean, it's something that's in terminal decline. Why not try and find the next generation of systems that's going to replace coal-fired generators? I've got, if you're one couple of little things from the Sydney Morning Herald on that particular issue, Abbott's quote was, the journalist writes about how the Clean Energy Finance Corporation was supposed to be killed in the Senate. This is Mr. Abbott saying, as long as it exists, it might as well be useful as possible and invest in new and emerging technologies, the things that might not otherwise get finance. Now, Andrew Robb, in 2011, when they were in opposition and the Labor Party was raising the idea of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, he claimed money would be spent, quote, on all sorts of wild and wacky proposals the banks would not touch in a fit. If that's the case, then if the Clean Energy Finance Corporation is now going to be investing in wild and wacky ideas, then maybe you're right. Maybe your conspiracy theory about them trying to gut it by stealth, maybe they're hoping it'll go belly up financially.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So there we go. Abbott and his cohort at it again. And I think the majority of the Australian public cannot wait for the next election, Scott, to boot him out.
I think there's a real chance they will be one-term wonders. Mm.
Yep.
You know, I mean, unless, of course, too much damage has been done out of this Union Royal Commission for Shorten, who knows? We'll see. Mm. But I think there's a real strong possibility they could be one-term wonders.
Mm. Anyway, that's...
It's going to make Paris embarrassing, isn't it?
What's that? Make what?
It's going to make Paris embarrassing, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So, well, it's just... I'm just embarrassed, full stop, every time I see them. I'm just embarrassed for our country. But, Scott, that's probably going to wrap us up for the week. There wasn't, you know, the Christians, the Muslims, the Hindus, the Jews, the Buddhists, they're all very quiet this week. They haven't... I think they've heard about the podcast and they've kept a low profile, perhaps.
Well, yeah, they may well be quaking in their boots that you and I are on the loose. Who knows?
That could be it. But a quiet week in terms of truly secular issues. But
absolutely.
But
look, I'll just leave our listeners with one little thought for them tomorrow while you're at the office. Mm-hmm. Just remember that by the... you get to the office at 8:30, you knock off at 5. In that time, the Commonwealth Government, via special purpose grants to the state, will have spent in excess of $260,000 on the National School Chaplaincy Program.
Ouch. Oh, don't. goodness me. Scott, that's a bad note to leave it. Oh, I'm going to edit something more positive in just to finish.
I want people to get angry about that program.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're Usual disclaimer, we're members of the secular party, not necessarily the views of the secular party expressed. I'm going to put a big disclaimer on our... Oh, we've got a Facebook page, Scott. 22 likes.
So we wanted to double it last week and go to 16. Yep. So we have smashed that record.
Yep. I'm setting a new target next week, 44.
44. Yep. All right, people, you've got to go get yourselves one of each. Each of you has got to find one friend to like the Facebook page.
Like the Facebook page, and that will then send you to some links. We've actually got a new website, ironfistvelvetglove.com.au. So that's being developed. It's up and running, but we'll be adding to it, and we'll be adding little bits and pieces there of maybe some of the links of some of the articles we refer to and things like that. So that will all happen. But alrighty, thank you, Scott, and thank you, everyone.
You're very welcome.
And
good night all.
Bye for now. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.